start. We'll call the meeting to order when we have a quorum. If you can go ahead and start presenting your bill, I would note for members that when we do call the meeting to order, this bill will be laid over. But if you can just go ahead and start, Representative Freiberg.
Sure. I have an author's amendment.
You do, and we will. But we're not going to pass until we have a quorum.
Understood.
So.
Okay. Sure. Well, just by way of background, I was on the city council in Golden Valley for 9 years. In Golden Valley, we have on the city website, we have you can sign up for email notifications. Basically, just check the box of the things you want to be notified on.
Representative Freiberg, hold up. Sure. We do have a quorum. Members of the meeting of the Civil Law Committee will come to order. The first agenda item, I assume members have thoroughly reviewed the minutes from, what was the date of this?
January 15th.
Do I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Motion has been moved. All in favor of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Moving on, I'd ask for a motion to get the bill before the committee. Representative Freiberg.
So moved.
Representative Hillstrom has moved it. You, Representative Freiberg, would you please explain your author's amendment? I believe it's the DE1 amendment.
Yeah, it makes a couple changes to the bill. I guess I'll just launch into that if that's okay.
And if we could note also, Representative Freiberg, there's a typo, so if you would make your oral amendment to the typo on line 1.12, the two and the are squished together. So that would be an oral amendment. Go ahead.
Sure. It makes two changes to the bill as was introduced. First, it adds item 3 on line lines 111 and 12 relating to internet username, passwords, internet protocol. This was done pursuant to recommendation from the City of Minneapolis IT Department to make that information private. Secondly, in the bill as it was introduced, there was a provision allowing governments to share information with other governments. Several members, as I understand it, raised concern with that language, so this removes that language from the bill.
Okay, thank you. Can I have a motion to get the bill in the shape that Representative Freiberg would like?
So moved.
Motion has been moved. All in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Okay. To the bill as amended, Representative Freiberg.
Sure. Well, as I mentioned, I was on the City Council in Golden Valley for several years. On the city website, we had notifications that we can send out to residents who are interested, whether it's on snow emergency routes or changes in the recycling schedule, sending the City Council or Planning Commission agenda packets to them. You just check the box of the thing you're interested in, and the city will send you information on it. So I was somewhat surprised to read this article from last August. I understand all the members here have been handed it out on, it's an NPR story just about how data such as email addresses on notification lists aren't private. In this case, this story concerned a political campaign where a political candidate had filed data practices requests with all of the cities in the area she was running to get email addresses, presumably so that she could send campaign-related materials to them. And I was just surprised by that. You know, as a city representative, I don't think people were signing up for snow emergency notifications with the expectation that their email addresses would be private for commercial or political purposes. So the bill would address that. You know, and as I understand it, there is precedent for it. I understand if a person signs up for a library card, like with the Hennepin County Library, just for example, you submit, among other things, your email address, and in that context, at least, the Data Practices Act makes that information private as well. So this is comparable to that. That's what the bill does, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg. Are there questions? Representative Holbert?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I didn't hear that you moved DE1 as amended, so I don't know.
So
the typo, what if you want to, whatever.
Okay.
That's your call. But
I'm going with the whatever, Representative Holbert. But
all right.
Yes. No, I think you're right. So we need to move it as, okay. So I would move do we need to move the oral amendment then? Separately?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So as the oral amendment, as stated on line 1.12, why don't we have research state the oral amendment, just so everyone's clear on that.
Mr. Chair, the amendment would be page 1, line 12 of the DE1 amendment. Delete T-O-T-H-E and insert 2 space the.
Okay. To that, as stated, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed say no. Motion passes. Okay, then, again.
Mr. Chair, then I had a question.
Go ahead, Representative Holbert.
All right, thank you. The section 13.04, subdivision 2, what is that? What's the notwithstanding and what's the effect of that?
Sure. This is kind of a new area to me, but as I understand it, there's it's the Tennyson warnings. Those provide protections when the government asks or requires the submission of personal data. In this case, since signing up for a listserv is entirely voluntary, and the purpose of signing up for a listserv is clear, this was recommended, I think, by IPAD, which is not a consumer product. It's the Information Policy Analysis Division of the Department of Administration. They felt that these were not necessary in this circumstance, just because the government's not asking for the information. If I have that correct, this is supported also by the League of Minnesota Cities, and I know Patrick's here from there too, so he can also answer some questions, need be.
Representative Holbert.
And then just to be clear, somebody could still get a list of names and, if they had them, addresses, snail mail addresses of people on the listserv.
Representative Freiberg.
That would be correct, assuming that they submitted that information on the listserv.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Representative Freiberg? Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Freiberg, why protect the telephone number and email address but not the regular address?
Representative Freiberg.
I mean, I guess I wasn't, that information is often public, whether it's through property records or that sort of thing. I mean, I was just kind of interested in getting at the email notification issue identified in the story. I think that information is often public. You know, if the committee were interested in including that, it's certainly something I could look at. I don't know if Patrick has any comments on it too, but as I said, I was just mainly interested in getting at the issue in the story.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Representative Freiberg? Okay, seeing none, Chair lays this bill over.
Actually, we have some testifiers.
Oh, that's right. Thank you. We have testifiers. Absolutely. You can send your testifiers up, Representative Freiberg. No, I saw it on the sheet, but.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Councilmember, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Tolbert, and I represent the City of St. Paul on the City Council. I'm also here as a board member of the League of Minnesota Cities, which also supports this bill. This is an important bill both for St. Paul and for cities across the state, because these are emails, these are text message numbers, these are phone numbers that people voluntarily sign up for, that we believe people don't sign up with the expectation that this is public data and that it will be sent out across to spammers, to political candidates, whoever may request this data. In the City of St. Paul, we use this system for things like public health updates, for police updates, for early notifications of building contracts, things like that. We do it for community updates. Things like the email that we all get from committees, we send that out from our council to these people who voluntarily sign up for it. And I believe one of the most important things we use it for is our snow plowing, snow emergency system. This is voluntary data, or voluntarily signed up for, and the data that is sent out, anyone can sign up for it. Nobody's excluded from it. You could sign up for it. You don't have to be a St. Paul citizen. And that message is always going to be public, and people can search that. One example of how useful this is and cost-effective that this system is for cities is a few weeks before Christmas, we had a huge snowstorm in the City of St. Paul. We had our normal snow emergency, but because of the way that the snow fell and the ability for our snow trucks to get out, the result of the plowing wasn't particularly great. about a few days later, our mayor and our public works decided to do a non-obligatory snow emergency where we didn't tag or ticket or tow, but we asked people to voluntarily move their cars off the street so we could come through. And we did this entirely through, some news media covered it, but through the text message system, through the email, and through the phone calls, which usually goes to the more senior residents with a voice message. And after conversations with our public works, I think our compliance in the city of cars moving off the street, even in the college areas where the text messages are often used, was almost as good as a normal snow emergency where you have the notification of snow. And so this is really a cost-effective way of doing government. And if we don't have this ability, if it is public data, we'd be obligated to tell our citizens when they sign up for this that your email address or whatever information you may give is public, and we believe that would discourage people, and people who don't think about that may be out there, and the information that spammers could get might be used inappropriately against these people with city-type emails to this group of people. We ask that this legislation is passed, that you consider it. It's, as I said before, it's not the message. The message will be public to anybody. Anybody can sign up for it, and that's searchable. But this private data for our private citizens, we believe, should be classified as non-public data. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilman. Representative Holbrook.
Thank you. In thinking through this, I mean, I think that giving people the tennis in your comments about that it might scare them and you don't want to have to do it, I think it's really important that it is done. But are all of these notifications that are used through these processes posted in a website? In other words, if I'm somebody who I don't want to put my name to an address to appear on a list, am I able to just find these things out by monitoring a website?
Councilmember Tolbert.
On most of them you would be able to. You could monitor that website. In the city of St. Paul, I can't speak for all.
Do you, if you Ripson know, Holbrook. Would the, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, and would, do you think the League of Minnesota Cities would be agreeable to a requirement that these listserv notices be posted on a website? So, in other words, if we're going to be sending things out through these systems, that they would also post them so that if you're a citizen that doesn't want to become involved in this process and don't like a bunch of emails, but you want to know what your government is doing and what they're telling people, you would know that all of these notices would be posted publicly as well.
Councilmember Tolbert.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Mr. Hines has an answer to that. Come forward and identify yourself, Mr. Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Patrick Hines with the League of Minnesota Cities. Representative Holbrook, that is certainly something we will discuss with our cities. I wouldn't want to say today for certain that every email or text message can be posted on the website. I just don't know enough about the process, but we'll ask and see if that's something that is being done already. It may, in fact, be done, but I just don't know. But we'll find out for you.
And just
Representative Holbrook.
What my concern about this is that if, say, the city sends out information that's inaccurate or maybe not all of the information, under current law, somebody would have the ability to then get the list and correct the record, if you will, or provide an alternative view. What would be the duty of local units of government to right a wrong, if you will.
Before you answer that, Representative Freiberg, did you have a response you wanted to make to that?
Well, just to the first point, I can pass if you want to that this question answered specifically. But just on the first point, I was just going to say, at least in the case of Golden Valley, too, most of the information is on the city website as well. The advantage of the email notification system is that a lot of it is time sensitive, and unless you're monitoring the website constantly, you're not going to know when information gets published, whether it's because snow emergencies, like Councilmember Tolbert mentioned, that's happening suddenly. The council agendas get posted at a specific time. So, you know, there is an advantage to being able to sign up and to get an email notification in that you don't have to constantly monitor the city website.
Mr. Hines, did you have an answer to Representative Holbert's question?
Yes. I think the question was about correcting any inaccuracies that are posted. And obviously the city wants to publish accurate information. It defeats the purpose to have inaccurate information out there. And if you're talking about information that is deemed inaccurate by another group, not saying that the time of a snow emergency is wrong, but something more substantive than that, I think the citizens that receive this information hold city councils accountable for what is sent out there. There are already restrictions in statute about what local units of government can and cannot say about certain issues. Those laws remain in force. And this issue, I think, is an example of how citizens do enforce and hold cities accountable, because when citizens were made aware that their email addresses were being given to third parties as required by law, they raised concerns with local officials who brought them here to the league, and we've assisted them in bringing this legislation forward. I don't think that citizens are signing up to have sort of a open blog or dialogue with interest groups who may, you know, disagree with the city on a certain policy. That is certainly their right and may be very well intentioned, but you know, whether it's a solicitor or a candidate or an interest group, people I think generally do not want to be receiving lots of emails simply because they've asked to be notified about city information.
Right. And Mr. Chair, I get that part of it, but there's also a saying, you can't fight City Hall. I would say in this case, you can't correct City Hall. Occasionally, cities have agendas or projects or goals that maybe not all the citizenry support. And currently, they would be able to get that list and send out their information, too, if it was counter to what the city was informing, or some may say using propaganda, you know, depending on where you sit on an issue. And so we're going to close off that venue if, you know, when we make these emails not available. And so I'm just trying to think, how would somebody that was quote unquote fighting City Hall or wanted to get their side of the story to the same universe of users, how would they do that given this proposed change?
Representative Freiberg?
First of all, we haven't really had the chance to work together on this, but I do appreciate your expertise in this area. I guess just coming from my perspective as the bill author, I do worry, you know, first of all, I think there is a precedent in this case. I mean, those arguments would apply as well in the case of library cards. I would say it's possible the library could send out information that people might disagree with, but the legislative, I think, was that a legislative change that makes library card information private? So, I mean, there is a precedent for this, and I view this kind of in a comparable light. I do, you know, I think these notification lists are a very valuable service that cities and counties and school districts provide, made possible by technology. I do worry that there, you know, if people learn that their contact information is public, there might be a chilling effect. And I do worry, you know, that this valuable service, these notifications that prevent people's cars from being towed, won't be taken advantage of to the maximum extent. So, I mean, I guess I just, you know, I would agree with Mr. Hines. I do think, you know, I do think people, there's an expectation people have that government isn't going to share their contact information with commercial interests or political interests. It hasn't happened a lot yet, but I do feel like, you know, once something like that starts and people become aware that it's out there, as, you know, as happened in that story, that NPR story, that it could happen a lot more. And I find that worrisome.
Okay, members.
Chair, I'm not disagreeing with some of your points. I'm just trying to think through inadvertent consequences, sure, of this policy change.
Representative Holbrook, this is going to data practices,
yep,
that you'll sit on. So, members, we have three questions, and I would remind members we're not voting on this today. It is going to data practices. No need to.
Well, actually, no, I do.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg, I'm just curious about your, and I'm going to commit one of the unforgivable sins of the legislature, which is asking a question about something that may have been discussed before I got here because I was late. But I've checked with two people who don't know the answer to this. You dropped the language talking about sharing the data with other governmental entities for governmental purposes, and since that's your amendment, I thought it would be appropriate to ask about it now when it was offered. Is it just because those are so ill-defined terms, or what's the concern?
Representative Fiverr, if you could restate that.
If I could restate it?
You said at the beginning you gave the answer.
Sure, yeah. No problem. There, as I understood, the language was in there initially because there might be situations where, at least in the snow emergency context, since we've been talking about that a lot, a city wants to share it with MnDOT. However, in the process of talking to members, Mr. Hines, I think, has done a lot of that. I think several members expressed concern with this language. They just weren't sure what it meant. Actually, maybe I should let you handle this since you probably had most of those conversations.
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, I think that's accurate. Members did express concerns because the language was broad, and while the intention was certainly not to make it overly broad so that the government, different entities could share in an unlimited fashion, the breadth of the language was such that we thought it made sense to take it out. If the data is classified as private, there are existing statutory and regulatory restrictions on how that data can be shared, and I think those are sufficient to protect the interest that's existing law now.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I was wondering the same thing, but I also just wanted to comment, because I'm a user of St. Paul's traffic notification system, even though I live in Rochester, not in St. Paul, but I think it's very useful. And, I'm a person who would give my information for that purpose but don't want it shared. So I really appreciate the bill. And I just wanted to comment to Representative Holberg's comments, which I think it's good to explore this, what the ramifications might be. But I think there's a big difference between government obtaining some kind of a big list and then using it to send out their messages, as opposed to this, which is people voluntarily asking to receive a communication from government. So when I ask to receive a communication from St. Paul about my parking restrictions, I take the risk that they might tell me something wrong. That's just the risk I take, but I'm not asking for somebody else to tell me they're wrong. I'm trusting St. Paul. If I don't trust them to give me the right information, I don't have to give them my email address. So I think that this is a very appropriate bill, and I do hope that it moves forward, and appreciate your bringing it, Representative Freiberg. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Freiberg, question, how many complaints has the Department of Administration's Policy Analysis Division ever received on this subject?
Representative Freiberg.
I don't know the answer to that. Is somebody from the Department of Administration here? Maybe you should ask that, not me.
I don't see anyone, Representative Anderson. But oh, yeah, we do have someone here. Ms. Christensen, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Stacey Christensen. I'm the administrator of the Information Policy Analysis Division, the Department of Administration. We have not had any formal complaints with regard to these data. We certainly received a number of questions after the NPR story came out and the data requests came in, just in terms of how the data were classified and kind of the ramifications about that. But we have not had any formal complaints about it specifically.
Representative Harrison?
Okay. All I need to know.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, members, this bill is going to be laid over. I thank the testifiers, Representative Freiberg. After conversation with Representative Holberg on the floor, Representative Holberg did remind me that there is risk of sending all these separately to the floor, and we are going to consider them jointly in the data practices subcommittee. So with that, the bill is laid over. Representative Hortman, are you ready to go?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 19.
Okay, the House File 19 has been moved to be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. There's also an author's amendment, A1. Would you explain the author's amendment, Representative
Mr.
Portman?
Chair, this gets the bill in the shape that the Minnesota probate bar would like it to be.
Well, with that...
My testifier will address the bill in its entirety once we amend it. I'd like to move
that,
the A1.
All in favor of Amendment A1, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. So to your bill as amended, Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Today I have with me Mike Sampson, who's a member of the probate bar in Minnesota, to explain the bill and why we need it.
Thank you, Mr. Sampson. Please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. This bill is a part of the Uniform Multi-Party Accounts Act, an amendment that was made to the Uniform Act after Minnesota's version of the statute was passed initially. And it adds something we think would be a useful addition to Minnesota law, the ability for a banking customer to name someone as an agent on an account rather than making them a joint owner of the account. A typical example would be someone comes into the bank with their adult child, and they want the child to help them with bill payment. The bank teller gives them a joint account card. They fill that out so that they're both signers on the account. When the parent dies, by law, the child owns the whole account, even if there are other children, and the testator would have wanted that money to be shared equally with all of their children. What this does is allows the customer essentially the option to do what they really want, which is give someone the power to sign their name without giving them an ownership interest in the account. Fairly straightforward, but a very important change for Minnesota law, I think.
Okay, are there questions from members of the committee? Representative Yarusso, go ahead.
Not so much a question as a comment. I've been in this situation with my mother's accounts. I was put on, you know, as a joint account, and realized at her death that that did create a funny situation where I was completely in charge of that account, and it was kind of up to me to distribute that money to my siblings. And these are the kinds of things you don't recognize until you get into that situation, you know, because we don't worry about it until you're there. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Yarusso. Any other questions? Oh, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this sounds like a really good idea, but I just want to explore it a little bit to make sure that it doesn't have some unintended consequences. So I guess I have two questions. One is whether or how many states are doing it like this, or if we would be the first.
Mr. Sampson.
Okay, we'll do that first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As to the number of other states that have adopted this amended version of the Uniform Act, I don't know the answer off the top of my head, but I could look that up. The Uniform Law Commissioners keeps track of which states have adopted the statute. But it is part of the current Uniform Act, and I believe it's been adopted by over 38 states generally. So we're clearly in the majority there.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the other question kind of pertains to what Representative Yarusso was talking about. If we change the law and say she was designated as the agent on her mother's account, would she and her sibs have a difficult time or a more difficult time accessing the money, and or could they also be designated as co-owners on the account so that the money would just pass to them and they could get access to it immediately? I mean, how does that complicate the picture?
Mr. Sampson.
Yes, the Multiple Party Accounts Act statute also allows someone to designate a payable on death or POD beneficiary on an account. So in your example, the mother could designate the child that she wants to have assistance with on bill payment as the agent, and then name all three children as the pay on death beneficiaries in equal shares, so that child number one could do the bill payment, and when mother dies with a presentation of a death certificate, the account would automatically belong to all three children.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or commentary to the bill? Seeing none, then Representative Horton renews her motion that, or I should ask, are there any other testifiers in the audience to this bill? Okay. Representative Horton renews her motion that House File 19 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary Finance and Policy. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Horton. Thank you, Mr. Sampson. Representative Winkler, are you prepared? Is there any movement? Representative Winkler moves House File 87.
Be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy.
Excellent. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have no amendments. I do have a testifier, Mr. Dunleavy, from the Real Property section of the bar. And just as by way of introduction, Mr. Chair, some concerns about one section of this bill were raised by legal aid. The section of law is just restating another section of law, but we have committed to work with legal aid and the real property section of the bar to resolve that question in the Judiciary Committee, but this came up too late to resolve this morning. But given Representative Portman's sitting on both committees, I think we can resolve it.
Understood. Thank you. Mr. Dunleavy.
Mr. Chair, I'm Kevin Dunleavy. I co-chair the Legislative Committee of the Real Property section of the State Bar Association. The first section of this bill is intended to address a problem that arises with deeds that are used for estate planning, and that would be joint tenancy deeds, deeds reserving a life estate, and transfer on death deeds. And what happens with those types of deeds, when the person dies, there's an affidavit and a death certificate that's recorded in the real estate records to show the passing of the person. Unfortunately, the survivors keep getting the tax statements addressed to the person who already died. So, and that causes some discomfort for the survivors. So what this bill does is it says that now affidavits of survivorship should show where the tax statements go, so that they will go to the survivors rather than to the decedent. Section 2 of the bill is regarding certificates of satisfaction. The existing practice now is that there are also, in addition to satisfactions, there's a use of releases of mortgages. And that's very common in developments where the mortgage is on 50 lots, and as the lots are sold off, one lot is released. So the existing practice is to use a partial release. All that this does is codify that practice. It allows, it gives a statutory authority for a partial release of a mortgage, and that's most commonly used in development situations. There is no substantive change in the law with Section 2. As far as the liability section, that's already existing law, and it's just rearranging the statute so that from a statutory construction standpoint, it's a little bit more clear what the statute's trying to do. And that's the section that Representative Winkler was speaking about, that the Bar Association will work with legal aid to respond to legal aid's concerns. The last section of the bill is merely a technical change. There used to be on Torrens property, which is certificated real property under Chapter 508, there used to be common element certificates of title. The terminology was changed to common interest community, common interest community certificates of title. So the change in terminology missed a couple of the old acronyms, and so that this is just cleaning up that, so that the references are consistent. That's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Dunleavy. Questions from members of the committee about the bill? Seeing none, then Representative Winkler renews his motion. Representative Winkler renews his motion that House File 87 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Winker. Thank you, Mr. Dunleavy. Representative Hillstrom.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members.
Good morning, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Hillstrom, you move House File 40. You recommend it to pass and be re-referred to your committee. Oh, I'm sorry, to Public Safety, Finance, and Policy.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, this bill was brought to me out of a collaboration that was going on between the Attorney General's Office and Anoka County Attorney Tony Palumbo. Members, we're seeing a rise in financial exploitation of vulnerable adults, as well as guardianship and conservator abuses. And so what this bill really does is it expands background checks of these guardians and conservators that the court is appointing to include whether or not they have had a license, either a law license or any other professional license that has been suspended, or if they've lost that license. It takes the background checks from every 5 years to every 2 years, and then it requires that additional information be disclosed by the people who are applying to be guardians. For example, if they've ever been found civilly liable for fraud or misrepresentation, this requires that those kinds of disclosures happen. And then it also requires that guardians disclose any information as well as changes in their criminal history within 30 days of an incident. The way that we pay for this increase in the background checks and the expansion of what will be checked is by increasing the fee that guardian pays when they have that background check by $2. This should more than pay for being able to check licenses in states that they previously lived in. I have heard from the department, and they would like clarification of which states we want them to check their, when they do their background check, and we will work on the language of making certain that it's only states those people have lived in or practiced law, and they don't need to check, you know, California if the guardian has never been in nor practiced any kind of business in California. So we'll be clarifying that. But with me, I have a testifier from the Attorney General's office who will talk a little bit about what brought this issue forward.
Thank you, Mr. Voigt. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm David Voigt. I'm a Deputy Attorney General. What the Attorney General is trying to do with this bill is to provide better information to judges to strengthen the screening out process for people who are appointed by the courts to be guardians. The people that need guardians and conservators are people who are vulnerable adults. They're people who can't take care of their finances on their own, and so they need to turn over those responsibilities to someone else. So it's extremely important to have somebody who's responsible enough to take on those duties. The current law provides for a background check that involves a criminal history check every 5 years. But what it doesn't get at is other types, other kinds of history that really may reflect just as well on how responsible a person is to handle somebody else's finances. It doesn't check for civil judgments. It doesn't check for bankruptcies. It doesn't check licensing information for licensed professionals. And that's the kind of thing that those are the places where this bill strengthens it. From the Attorney General's perspective, the impetus for this bill was a case that our office prosecuted in Rice County. Terry Hauge was an attorney, a licensed attorney in the 1990s, and she was suspended from the practice of law for lying to clients and for mishandling cases. And rather than going back to get her attorney license reinstated, she got into the business of being a court-appointed guardian. and along with another individual, had formed a company that was the fourth largest business in the state that provided those court-appointed guardians services. What we found in the case that we prosecuted in Rice County was that she was stealing money from a lot of her clients. And these are people who were living on incomes of probably less than $1,000 a month, mostly just Social Security and whatever other benefits they got. And as a result of stealing money from these people, it not only left them financially destitute, but it left some of them in some real dangerous situations. There was one client who, when the thefts were discovered and family members went to his apartment, he was absolutely living in squalor with no edible food in the apartment. And part of that was due to the failure of Ms. Haughey and the failure of her to provide this client with money to support himself. There was another client involved in that case who was released from emergency medical care in a town that he wasn't familiar with, and just left in a motel, and he couldn't get at his money. Now, we were able to prosecute that case with the existing laws, but what this bill is about screening that person out in the first place. Because maybe if the judges who had appointed that company in the multiple counties that they were appointed, if they had known this history of the suspension of the law license, maybe this all could have been prevented in the first place through the screening process.
Thank you, Mr. Voigt. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, I guess, goes to the bill's author, and I think this is something that we really have to address, especially with the aging population that is going to soon be retiring and getting aged and requiring these services. Mm-hmm. But my concern is the fiscal part of this, and I'm just wondering if a fiscal note has been requested. I see that, you know, we're going from checking on these people every 5 years to every 2 years. There's got to be a cost to that, both in terms monetarily and in terms of perhaps additional staff to the BCA or the Health and Human Services. You're going to be checking licensing. So I'm just, a $2 increase to me is not going to cover it. So I'm just wondering, are there reductions in a budget somewhere else to compensate for this, or has a fiscal note been asked for?
Representative Hill.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, a fiscal note has been requested. We are going to cover the cost by the people who are requesting their backgrounds be checked. So if it's, we're requesting $2, if it's a dollar, we'll put a dollar. If it's $3, we'll put $3. This should not have additional state costs. The people who are requesting to have the background check will be the ones that will be paying for it. And members, I just wanted to say that, you know, this isn't just a Minnesota problem. This is a national problem as well. And the United States Government Accountability Office recently did a study, and they identified hundreds of allegations of physical abuse, neglect, and financial exploitations by guardians in 45 different states and the District of Columbia. And they studied between 1990 and 2010, and they selected 20 cases that were already closed to look at, and they found that guardians had stole improperly obtained $5.4 million in assets from 158 incapacitated victims. And some of these victims were also abused and neglected besides. And so, members, I really think this is the right direction to go, and it's a matter of just making certain that we hit the right amount to make certain that there is an additional state cost.
Other questions for members of the committee? Representative Howe.
Yes, Chair, and I guess my question would go to Representative Hillstrom. My question is how do we settle on the 2 year? I mean, we're going from 5 years to 2 years. Why not three? Why not annually? I guess that would be my question. How did the 2 year cycle come up?
Representative Hillstrom.
Well, we just thought that, Mr. Chair and members, we just thought that it needed to be more often. And in fact, you know, many times if you're charged with a criminal case, it does take more than a few months. And so certainly every year might be too quickly, but 2 years certainly is enough. But if you want to do every year, I'm fine with every year. I just think that it needs to be more often than 5 years.
Representative Howe?
Have we got any other states that do this? Do we have any background of whether 5 years doesn't work? I mean, I understand that I agree that we need to do more thorough background, but I'm just questioning, you know, why not 5 years? If we're doing a thorough background check on this on these folks, and we really get to the background, have we got any documentation that says that 5 years doesn't work?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, we don't have documentation on the number of years. I just think that more frequently is better, and I'm advocating for 2 years.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Question from the chair by way of comment. I remember I'm an employer who caught a fellow employee stealing one time, and what we are talking about here is essentially theft. And he said a third of the employees you hire will never ever steal from you. A third will steal if they're not properly monitored, and a third will take whatever's not nailed down whenever they can. That was his perspective on it, uneducated, anecdotal. But my question is about these situations where suddenly people are thrust in the context of managing someone else's money, and they justify it to themselves somehow, saying that it's okay for them to take this stuff because whatever reason. And obviously, in the case of the criminal law, you need to prove it. You stated, Mr. Voigt, that in these contexts, you were able to establish proof beyond a reasonable doubt with existing laws. But I'm wondering about those situations that we never hear about and never end up hearing about from people who pilfer from the people they're supposed to help with some kind of justification. And will this law get at that?
Mr. Chair and members, well, this is one piece that we're working on, and there are other pieces, and the court is the one that has to monitor these guardianships and conservatorships, and they are also working on some database upgrades and some of those kinds of things. And so this is one piece of a there's going to be a number of proposals to deal with this issue. As we have an aging population, more and more seniors will find themselves in this situation, and we as the government need to get our hands around not appointing folks who are actually going to take advantage of the very people we have decided we need to try to take care of.
Thank you. Representative Uerso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am in favor of this on the whole. I just wanted to make a comment that if we're going to consider fiscal implications of it, that we remember that if we have a person who's in need of guardianship and they lose their assets through fraud, they will then become a financial responsibility of the state. And I recognize that that will be difficult to quantify because it's a kind of anecdotal issue, but it's something to keep in mind for this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Uerso. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to sort of support Representative Howe's question, which I think was a good one. I mean, I think this is a really serious issue, and I appreciate the intent of the bill, and I think we do need to do a deeper background study. But I think there's a, we don't do any, when we do more of something, it isn't necessarily cost-free, and I don't mean the financial cost, because I get the answer to that, and not only that, this isn't a fiscal committee, and I know this will be dealt with elsewhere. But I just wonder if 2 years is really the right thing. I mean, I guess I'd like to know more about what kinds of, you know, yeah, more is better, I guess, if we only have the element of if finding, you know, if there's a reasonable expectation that will be the right cycle at which to catch new stuff. But I would like to know, I think, along with Representative Howe, if there's really any data, anything to show that more really is better. Because it does have a cost of some kind, if only in a bureaucratic machinery that has to be accessed to do these checks. So if there was any more information on that or anything that would give, if you will, to use that term people love to hate, evidence-based, I think that would be really helpful.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, we will do some looking to see what other states do. I just want this body to know that in the case of Ms. Haughey, she was actually going through difficulties in one county and being setting up business in another, and that the new county was appointing her as guardian to more and more people as she was being investigated in this other county because there wasn't this requirement that she disclose. There wasn't a requirement to do more frequent background checks, and there wasn't a requirement to look at what happened to her law license. And so we need to make certain that, you know, one, people are being looked at more frequently, and two, that the communication is available between counties, and that this information has to be disclosed. And so there'll be an obligation here for her to disclose, or someone to disclose, within 30 days of something happening.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, one of the things that is the very common driver of fraud, and it's not necessarily just in this context, but in any context of fraud or embezzlement, basically people put in a position of trust and have the opportunity to take money that isn't theirs, is gambling, the financial problems that are associated with severe gambling losses. And I don't know that you could pick up problem gambling in a background check. I suspect there probably is not a mechanism for doing that. But I wonder if the Attorney General's office or you have looked at that issue and tried to find some policy response to deal with some of the financial incentives that people have to do what Representative Lesch talked about, which is borrow money on a temporary basis in order to cover their own personal financial liabilities that they fully intend to pay back in their own mind, but just keep taking instead. It's very common, and it's not just in this context. And I don't know if there's a policy response that would fit besides, you know, Gamblers Anonymous and all those other things that we do. But if you've given that any thought.
Representative Hillstrom?
Mr. Chair, not in the context of this bill, I have given it no thought.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom and the Attorney General's office, I mean, I think that would be a very, if we're talking about actually addressing a problem, we can put together mechanisms that would allow us to do some of these things. But if you look at the list of things we're checking on, that they have to be very severe before they're going to be picked up. And a lot of what Mr. Representative Lesch talked about was things that sort of happen that we never really know about. And addressing the underlying motivations of people who are put in positions of trust seems like it would maybe go along, it could go a long way to addressing it. So it seems to me that that would be a fruitful area for the Attorney General's office to look into.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom, I have a question for you, a concern as well here. This, I agree with the intent of what you're doing here. One of the concerns that I want to bring up is that it seems to be that there's an atmosphere that is being generated that assumes that just because you have something in your past that you are guilty to commit something fraudulent in the future. I'm going to give you a hypothetical here. Let's say I'm reading here. It would include the revocations of professional licenses if they've been denied, suspended, or revoked. If, let's say, for example, I was a hairdresser and my hairdressing professional license had been revoked for some type of technicality, of course, this information would be made known. And because, you know, 5 years ago or 2 years ago, I had my hairdresser's license revoked or my barber's license, this immediately, you know, I'm reading the tone of this. This immediately tells me that I'm going to be inclined to steal money from someone I'm in guardianship over. I just want to address that there's an underlying tone here that says if you've had problems in the past, even though you've made restitution or gone through the process to correct those problems in the past, what this seems to be doing is it's assuming that guilty in the past means you're going to do something bad in the future. Now, I agree with the intent of this bill, but I just want to be mindful of the tone that seems to be the foundation that's being laid here for this. And is there or will there be any way for people that do run into this? Let's say you want to take care of your grandparent or your parent, and 2 years ago you had your commercial driving license revoked or suspended. And as you know and as I know, records can get lost or muddied up in the system. And let's say it was a technicality, something that you didn't actually do and you were let off on, but the system didn't catch up with that. And now I'm going to sit down and try to become, a guardian over my grandfather, and the court's looking at this and they're saying, well, you had your CDL pulled 2 years ago. on this issue, and now they're assuming I'm going to steal money from my grandfather. Is there a method built into this where people that can appeal this and say, look, you know what, this was a driving violation, I'm not going to steal from my grandfather or my grandmother, what kind of quality control or what kind of safety stop is going to be put in here? Because when I'm looking at this looks like it assumes that if you were guilty in the past, then you're going to be guilty in the future, which I think is a dangerous path to go down. Now, I will say this one last time, I do agree with the intent of what you're doing here, but I think we need to be careful here. Could you address that?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And all this does is give the judge additional information, and the judge will ultimately have the decision-making power of whether to appoint or not appoint. It just says the information has to be disclosed. For example, if you have your parent who maybe you want to be a guardian over, but three or four of your brothers and sisters didn't know that you filed bankruptcy or didn't know that you had some other issues, this will just give the judge the information, and so everybody can just take a closer look to make certain that that's a good fit.
Representative Simon.
I only ask this question because Mr. Boyd is here, and I know this isn't a committee that deals with criminal law, but do you think that the criminal sentences are adequate in this area for people who do as this attorney did? I know we've had high-profile cases. Judge Amundson of the Court of Appeals was probably the highest-profile case about, what was it, 6, 7, 8 years ago, where an actual sitting judge on the Court of Appeals, who was a guardian and who is now rightly serving a prison sentence, had embezzled, I think, hundreds of thousands of dollars from someone with developmental disabilities. I know he was made an example of, and appropriately so, but just what's your opinion generally about whether we're doing enough on the criminal side?
Mr. Roy.
Thank you. It's very difficult for me to generalize because maximum sentences are pretty high. As you know, in Minnesota we have guidelines, and we've seen cases where judges have imposed severe sentences, and rightly so, for this kind of conduct. We've also seen cases where sentences have looked light to us. So it's really a case by case determination, in my opinion.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Simon, I'm so glad you asked because I'm going to have two criminal law provisions that we'll be seeing later as well. But one of the challenges really comes is when you have a vulnerable adult population that is aging rapidly and you have these criminal cases that are going on. You need to make certain that you take care of them in a rapidly enough fashion so that their competency isn't further diminished, and also that death doesn't result later on, because you have to have witnesses in order to prove up criminal cases as well.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe this is something that is commonly known, because I know they have to do these background checks for other cases, but what is done with those, with that background check? Is it then, because it's part of a court file that's public, is that all public information, that background check, or is that sealed in some way? How's that person's private information protected?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would retain the status that it currently has, whatever that is in statute, and I don't know off the top of my head what that is, but I certainly can look it up. We're not making any changes to the status of that data as it exists today.
Okay, so being part of the court, thank you, Mr. Chair, being part of that court file wouldn't take something that's potentially non-public and make it public? Is what you're saying?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Whatever current law says it is today, that's what it would be after this bill, if this bill becomes law. And so maybe House Research can tell us the status today of what that information is. Because this is already happening. It's just happening every 5 years, and it's just not as expansive.
Right. Okay.
Any follow-up, Representative Scott?
No, I'm good.
Okay.
Thanks.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I got a question going back to Representative Neuberger's questions, but more on the cost of the background checks. I've been in law enforcement. I understand the thoroughness of a background check. At $20 or even at $22, you're probably looking at about a 10-minute background check. Is that going to be enough? Just $22 would be about 10 minutes worth of time looking into somebody's background. Do we need to raise this, or figure out what the actual cost of a background check costs.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are going to the Public Safety Committee next, who has the BCA, who, of course, does background checks, and so we will be fully vetting that issue. I don't believe that it's been considered a subsidized act previously, but we'll make certain that when we look at the fiscal note, when that comes in, that we address that issue.
Thank you. Representative Urso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can speak to whether the data is public with regard to the professional licenses, because I've been licensed as a professional engineer and also have a teaching license. When those licenses are suspended or revoked or whatever, that is already public information. You can already look those things up on state websites. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Urso. There being no other questions from members of committee, Representative Hillstrom renews her motion. The House File 40 be recommended to pass. It be referred to the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Mr. Voigt. Members, our next meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, January 29th at 8:15 right here. Please be on time. We will have a judge in front of the committee explaining, for some benefit of some of the new members and many of the returning members, the nuances of the civil law system as it is set up. I would also note that we do have a meeting a week from Friday.
Is it
at 9:30? At 9:30. We bumped it back for you non-morning people. But it is a 1 week from Friday morning to handle a different matter, but please note that, and a notice will be sent out on that. With no other matters before the committee, committee is adjourned.